طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. That is why it is so important that we broadcast it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. We are all struggling to understand the nuances of the International Court of Justice's ruling in South Africa's case against Israel, charging that Israel is committing a genocide against the Gazan population. Today we have just the person to guide us through the court's decision and help us understand its significance, Susan Ockram. Susan is professor at Boston University School of Law and heads their international clinic. We feature her in conversation with Ali Abu Nima and other journalists in an electronic intifada forum. The program begins with Nora Barrows Friedman framing the conversation.
Hello and welcome to a special episode of the Electronic Intifada's live stream. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman with my colleagues Asa Winstanley, Ali Abu Nima, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. Today we're taking a look at the International Court of Justice's ruling that was issued just hours ago, finding that Israel is committing the crime of genocide against Palestinians. The court ordered Israel to stop committing acts of genocide. Coming up in this broadcast, we'll talk about the implications of the ruling, what it means now in terms of Israel's genocide, and what comes next. The Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee stated that, quote, while the court fell short of explicitly ordering an immediate and permanent ceasefire, states must now be pressured to fulfill their legal obligations to actually stop the genocide and impose a ceasefire. Third, states must end their complicity and prevent genocide by, at the very least, ceasing arms transfers to Israel, as well as all military funding and diplomatic cover for its genocidal aggression. Palestinian lawyer Diana Boutu said that, quote, the ICJ ruling is an end to Israeli impunity. The ruling requires Israel to take measures to prevent genocide, to ensure effective aid enters Gaza, to ensure that its military does not commit genocide and prevent and punish those who incite to genocide. That was South African Foreign Minister Naledi Pandor. Meanwhile, Israel's genocidal officials are dismissing the ICJ's order. The Times of Israel reported that National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir called the court, quote, anti-Semitic. He said, quote, the decision of the anti-Semitic court in The Hague proves what is already known. This court does not seek justice, but rather the persecution of Jewish people. They were silent during the Holocaust, and today they continue the hypocrisy and take it another step further. Ben-Gvir claimed the ICJ was founded in 1945. It was not in operation during the Nazi Holocaust, but it is for this one. We're now joined by Susan Ockram. Susan is the director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University's School of Law. She's taught at the American University in Cairo and at Al-Quds and Birzeit Universities in Palestine, and is the author of many publications and scholarly articles about international law and Palestine. Susan, it's so great to have you with us, and thank you for joining us on such short notice.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Susan.
Hi, Ali.
So first off, your overall reaction to the International Court of Justice's ruling this morning.
So my first response is cautious optimism. The ruling did not go as far as, of course, many of us who were looking for a clear decision to halt the attacks on Gaza completely were. Yes, we were hoping for that. On the other hand, this decision is somewhere between the provisional measures that the court issued in the Myanmar case and in the Ukraine versus Russia cases. So it seems to thread a middle ground, and perhaps I think some of us could assume that the court was hoping for compliance and that there was possibly no expectation of compliance if there was a demand for a complete ceasefire. At the same time, there is a very high unanimity on the court on each of the provisional measures. And the measures track very closely the requirements of the Genocide Convention and basically say that Israel must stop engaging in any of the acts that it lists from the Genocide Convention, the presumption being that Israel is violating those provisions of the convention.
Susan, is this a defeat for Israel? Will Israel now have to contend with being associated with committing acts of genocide? What's your response to that?
Yes, well, absolutely on the second point, Israel will be associated with acts of genocide forever. Is it a defeat is a second question and depends very much on what actions states take to implement this decision. So the next step from this decision is that the court refers these provisional measures to the Security Council. We can expect a veto from the United States there, but it will likely again be taken up by the General Assembly. And there we know from the prior votes that the vast majority of the countries on this planet, as well as representing the vast majority of the people on this planet, that there will be a decision about how these provisional measures are to be carried out. And that's where the action is going to be. And where the responsibility for all civil society actors is going to play a major role in how their states respond to this and what they do to hold Israel to account based on what the court has indicated Israel must do.
You're a international law expert and educator with a great deal of experience and deep knowledge, and so you've taken a very careful look, as one would expect and want you to do. A lot of us who don't have that expertise and who are very hot-headed are reacting to this decision in all sorts of ways. And immediately a battle broke out on social media about what it means, with some people saying, oh, this is a worthless decision. It's a defeat for the Palestinian or South African side. It's a win for Israel, because particularly a lot of people hung up on this issue of the ceasefire. And you've said that you would have wanted that. And the South African foreign minister said she would have wanted that. And I, of course, would have wanted that. But I want to put to you sort of a different view on that as a layperson and get your view as a lawyer. And I just want to, for our audience, just read a little bit of what the actual order is, or the provisional measures, to use the court's term. And this was adopted by 15 votes to 2, so a very significant majority. It says the State of Israel shall, in accordance with its obligations under the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in relation to Palestinians in Gaza, take all measures within its power to prevent the commission of all acts within the scope of Article 2 of this convention, in particular, killing members of the group, causing bodily harm or mental harm to members of the group, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part, and imposing measures intended to prevent births within the groups. And then there are other parts of the order that go to making sure humanitarian aid and so on gets in, and incitement, preventing and punishing incitement. But I just want to reiterate this view that the court maybe took a view that this is tantamount to calling for a ceasefire, because how can you, as the South African foreign minister said, how can you prevent killing and mental and physical, mental and bodily harm without a ceasefire? It's effectively impossible. And how can you stop creating conditions that are calculated to make life impossible without a ceasefire and without ending the siege of Gaza? In a sense, this is broader than a ceasefire, because Israel could have a ceasefire. We've had ceasefires before, but within a ceasefire, you can still have the siege, you can still have starvation, you can still have denial of medical care and access for humanitarian aid. But the measures here are far broader, because they not only say stop the violence against Palestinians, they say also stop starving them. Effectively, it could be interpreted as stop besieging them, stop doing all these other things. And if they go to the Security Council, it would, you know, the US will probably veto it anyway. Let's not kid ourselves. But if there was the word ceasefire in there, wouldn't the United States say, well, we're going to veto this because calling for a ceasefire is negating Israel's so-called right to self-defense? Whereas it's much harder to oppose something like this, which says, stop doing genocide. They'll probably still veto it anyway. But I just wanted to put that view to you and get your reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so several responses to that. Number one, I started out by saying that the court is probably highly motivated by trying to get compliance. And you're exactly right. This, I would guess, a very uneducated guess, not being behind the scenes in the court's deliberations, but that they were much more likely to get a positive response at the Security Council if they did not call for a ceasefire. So I totally agree with that piece. On the other hand, if you look at these provisional measures and you connect the elements of genocide, so you see provisional measure one and provisional measure two, the second provisional measure says the state of Israel shall ensure with immediate effect that its military does not commit any of the acts. It's not saying these acts must stop or that the... It's, in other words, allowing the military to continue its operations, right? As long as it doesn't violate these provisions. Now, you have to think of...
Isn't that like saying the Israeli military can make an omelet, but it can't break any eggs?
In some ways, but you have to remember, again, that the elements of these particular elements of genocide must be connected with the statements of intent. Right. So if there's no intent, but these acts are being carried out in the context of a legitimate conflict, and the court has said nothing about that, about the legitimacy or not of the conflict. If these acts are being carried out within, and they are proportionate to the what is allowed under humanitarian law as part of a conflict, it's not genocide. So the court here is threading the needle very, very carefully. And I would not go so far as to say, just looking at the first provisional measure on its own, that it is the equivalent of demanding a ceasefire. Connect the first one to the second and connect that to the requirement of intent under the Genocide Convention. That's why I'm suggesting I'm cautiously optimistic about this ruling. I would not go so far as to be fully enthusiastic in the conclusion that by saying what it does in provisional measure one, that the court is saying the equivalent of a ceasefire. I think there's an argument that under two, and the intent piece, that Israel still has an argument to say, we can continue to conduct our operations, but they must be much more narrow, and they must be targeted, and they must not, to the extent possible, not kill civilians. So that's my take. I'm just digesting this and need to really go back to the other two rulings in the Myanmar and Ukraine versus Russia cases to unpack those, and in terms of what the consequences of that, those two orders have been on the other important bodies at the UN.
Mm-hmm. Susan, what about enforcement? I know that Israel was also ordered to, you know, report back to the court in 1 month. This is a binding order, but who and what can enforce the ruling of the court?
So we already talked about what happens next in terms of the mechanical consequences. It goes to the Security Council. The Security Council is going to have to decide. I'm guessing that if the Security Council does not implement the clearly implementable parts of this order, that it's going to again go to the General Assembly under something called, there's a 1950 resolution called Uniting for Peace, which allows the General Assembly to take action and put a resolution on the table when the Security Council fails to act, when there are breaches to peace. So that's actually how the General Assembly has been getting these resolutions on the table when the Security Council has failed. So I expect that mechanism will be used again for a continuing resolution, and that we will probably get another call for a ceasefire and perhaps much more specific actions out of the General Assembly. And then it is going to be up to, under the rubric of what is called erga omnes partes, that is, all state parties to the Genocide Convention are going to have obligations. And one would hope that the General Assembly in its resolution would spell out what those obligations are on all state parties as a matter of not just a resolution of the General Assembly, but as a matter of being state parties to the Genocide Convention. And as I mentioned before, this is where the action is going to be and where our work as civil society is going to be incredibly important, demanding accountability through our domestic governments, through our government's domestic acts. So that's the implementation. Now, of course, in the Ukraine versus Russia case, as a consequence of the provisional measures from the ICJ, the International Criminal Court, the prosecutor, issued a warrant for Putin's arrest. Now, we would hope, if that doesn't happen from the prosecutor, that individual states that have already shown their willingness to implement whatever orders the ICJ decides, that they will take this up through domestic legislation and their own criminal universal jurisdiction processes and issue warrants for the arrest of the principals prosecuting this war.
Susan, what impact specifically do you think this could have on, say, the arms trade with Israel? I mean, we know that there have been round-the-clock airlifts from the United States to Israel, and that's where the bombs come from to carry out this genocide. But it's not just the United States, it's the Netherlands, it's Germany, it's the United Kingdom, and many other countries. Legal expert Nimer Sultani tweeted, the EU, the UK, German, and US officials who met and indulged Isaac Herzog, Israel's president, and rushed to photos with Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, now need to confront the fact that their statements are Exhibit A in the genocide case. Do you think that they will carry on business as usual and continue to coddle and receive and praise people like Isaac Herzog? Or do you think this begins to change the way Israel is seen and treated, even among its so-called friends? Or are they just going to keep ignoring it? I mean, they just had, or they are having this week, Holocaust, International Holocaust Remembrance Day events, and once again saying never again and lighting candles while participating in a full-scale genocide. I mean, are they just beyond any hope? Is it up to the global South to take this on? Or is there any, does any of this matter in the so-called West?
It matters a great deal. It matters a great deal. And I think there's going to be a great deal more caution in dealing with the Israeli principles from, first of all, in the Western world, from the EU. And I think that is because there's dissent within the EU about the approach to what is happening in Gaza. We've heard from Spain. We've heard from Slovenia. And I think that dissent is going to grow. I mean, the Irish have been very loud about their opposition. I think with this ICJ decision, that it's going to give a larger platform to the dissenting voices within the EU. There is not going to be a uniform policy anymore from the EU, is my prediction, towards Israel, the fanfare towards Israel. There is going to be a great deal more caution. Now, the US, I think, is beyond hope. I'm sorry, until we get a lot more congressional voices supporting Bernie Sanders and Ayanna Pressley and the Congress people who are calling, who have been calling for a ceasefire. But I don't, that is not where the action is going to be at this point to hold Israel accountable. On the other hand, what we have to watch very closely is this case in California by the Center for Constitutional Rights. I would have expected that case to be dismissed from the get-go. The fact that it wasn't, and we're going to have arguments today in that case.
Can you that, just remind, we had someone from the CCR, the Center for Constitutional Rights, back literally months ago now to talk about that case. And that is a case... it's a civil suit, if I'm correct, in federal court against Joe Biden and other top officials, saying that they are failing in their obligations under the Genocide Convention to stop genocide. And the Genocide Convention is incorporated into United States law. It's part of U.S. law because the U.S. ratified the Genocide Convention and President Ronald Reagan signed it, I believe, in 1988. And there was a big push from supporters of Israel to get the United States to sign, to ratify that convention. It's hard to imagine any president today signing the Genocide Convention. I think that's that we've regressed even from Ronald Reagan. But so is that a fair summary of the lawsuit in California?
And that is that the lawsuit actually goes farther. It is charging complicity, which brings us back to your point about arms, because this is specifically about weapons delivery to Israel. And that's the main complicity between weapons delivery and, of course, billions of dollars that the U.S. has given to Israel to prosecute whatever wars it wants. So the complicity is really interesting because that's actually normally a very difficult element to prove, a difficult charge to prove. And in the past, civil suits under the same statute, which is the Alien Tort Claims Act, against Israeli defendants for a whole host of gross violations of human rights have failed at the jurisdiction stage. And they have been dismissed before even getting to the merits. So to my mind, we have a receptive court. We shall see how far this goes, but the efforts by the Biden administration to dismiss this lawsuit so far have not been successful. But this type of action, now in the U.S., we don't have pure criminal universal jurisdiction. It's all through this civil, it's all through the Alien Tort Claims Act, except for the Convention Against Torture. But other countries like Belgium, like the Netherlands, France, the UK, have the possibility of bringing of victims and victims' representatives, bringing cases to through their criminal procedures to get warrants issued and start criminal prosecutions. We don't have that here, but that's the equivalent in other countries. And that's where we hope civil society will begin those processes.
And that's very helpful. But just to clarify for our viewers who may not know all these terms, and I don't claim to know all of them. So there's international justice, things like the International Court of Justice, which we just watched today. That's the case we're focusing on. And that's a court that deals between states. It doesn't deal with individual accused individuals. Then you have the International Criminal Court, which I do want to come back to in a minute, which takes on criminal cases against individuals accused of various high crimes in international law, whether it's war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. And then you have universal jurisdiction, which you mentioned, which is where international crimes can be tried in the courts of a third country. And so let me give an example of that. Back in, I think it's more than 20 years ago now, a group of survivors sought to criminally prosecute Ariel Sharon, who was then the Prime Minister of Israel, in a Belgian court for the Sabra and Shatila massacre of Palestinian refugees in Beirut in 1982. And in that case, the United States actually pressured Belgium to change its laws, and they got Ariel Sharon off the hook. I think the Belgian court eventually said, oh, we don't have jurisdiction. I don't remember what the excuse was. But so there's that precedent where people have tried universal jurisdiction and the door has been slammed. Do you see now that this is a more... Why would things be different now? Let me put it that way.
Yes. So although Belgium... So there are several bases for jurisdiction over international crimes. And pure universal jurisdiction relates to, for example, under the Genocide Convention, every party to that convention is required to prevent and prosecute genocide. Under that convention, if you had pure universal jurisdiction, a state would be able to prosecute anyone, anywhere, regardless of where that crime took place, and regardless of that state's connection with that crime. Now, what has happened over the years, primarily because of efforts to hold U.S. and Israeli perpetrators accountable in domestic courts, is that pure universal jurisdiction has been narrowed in various domestic statutes, meaning principally that there needs to be some connection between the state that's prosecuting and the individual who is being prosecuted, or the state that's prosecuting and the actual crime. Now, countries vary dramatically in where they are on that spectrum of connection between that state and the territory. But under the Genocide Convention, and now what we're hearing from the International Court of Justice, this is an erga omnes obligation, meaning all states must prevent and punish. And because we've had the Myanmar and Gambia case, where the International Court of Justice has said, it doesn't matter what connection the state has to the crime. every state is required and has jurisdiction at the International Court of Justice for preventing and punishing genocide. So, yes, you're right. We have that Sharon precedent, but there are lots of other cases now going on against Syrian defendants, against Myanmar, against Russia in domestic courts under universal jurisdiction, under various aspects of their statutory provisions. So what I'm saying is there's lots of opportunity now. And right now we know that in the UK, the International Centre for Justice for Palestinians has filed a number of complaints with Scotland Yard to prosecute Israeli defendants for genocide in Gaza.
So just to try to spell this out a bit, for my understanding and for our viewers, so is what you're saying is that based on this ruling, this gives a green light to any country in the world to charge Yoav Gallant, Benjamin Netanyahu, whoever it may be, with acts of genocide under the convention, and issue an international arrest warrant that these people should be arrested and brought to whatever country it is to stand trial, and that this is what the International Court of Justice has green-lighted today. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And but again, it's state parties to the Genocide Convention. That's what this ruling is about. So yes, that's exactly right.
And so if someone, sorry, go ahead, Nora.
No, I just wanted to ask, you know, also as a layperson, would the US or, you know, any EU country or Canada or the UK be able to step in and try and thwart that from happening?
They could, but it's difficult. They need to have some significant leverage. Now, whether the US's leverage at this point is going to be sufficient against an awful lot of countries that have joined this request remains an open question. We shall see.
And let's go back to the International Criminal Court. That's a different institution from the International Court of Justice. People often confuse them. And again, the International Court of Justice, which is often called the World Court, goes back actually more than a century, its origins. And it's the top court to decide disputes between states. And I think they also deal with the Genocide Convention. And I think, do they also deal with the Law of the Sea?
Any conventions right, that have a provision that refer disputes, the jurisdiction of disputes to the International Court of Justice.
Right.
This is the court attached to the United Nations. So all UN charter members are subject to the jurisdiction of the International Court of Justice. And any rulings that apply to all of states' parties are binding on all UN charter members.
Right. So that's the International Court of Justice. It deals with disputes between states under various conventions of international law. And then, as we said, there's the International Criminal Court, which was only established in, I think it was 2000, under the Rome Statute. And not all countries are members. Most countries are members, but there's some notable exceptions. The United States, Israel, Russia. I don't remember them all, but it's a handful of countries. And that is a court of so-called last resort, which can issue arrest warrants against individuals. So, as you noted, they have issued an arrest warrant for the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin. And that, I believe, is the first time they issued an arrest warrant for anyone who wasn't from Africa. Because that's also been a major criticism of the International Criminal Court, is it's in effect acted as an international colonial court, a court for the West to go after you know, the leaders of countries they don't like, but it's never gone after, you know, a George Bush for his war of aggression against Iraq, or his war in Afghanistan, or Tony Blair, and so on. Karim Khan is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, and he has been very strongly criticized for dragging his feet on Palestine, where there are crimes. There's so many crimes he could prosecute, including the settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But he hasn't done so. And people have noted the incredible contrast with the way he immediately got on the case of Russia and issued an arrest warrant within months or weeks of the war beginning in February 2022, and has yet done nothing in relation to Palestine. So two questions with that background. One, why do you think that is, that he's done nothing up to now? And two, how do you think the International Court of Justice ruling changes that? There's no formal process where the ICJ influences the International Criminal Court, but explain how those things can be connected.
So on the first question about Karim Khan, there's a backstory that relates to backlash against the prior prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda. When Bensouda indicated, so first of all, there was, I think it took 5 years after Palestine became a party to the Rome Statute in 2014. It took about 5 years for the court internally to decide that it had jurisdiction over Palestine as a state. So that was a huge delay, even though Palestine had been submitting communications, you know, from the beginning of its ratification. And at that point, this was Fatou Bensouda, who decided, yes, Palestine was a state for purposes of jurisdiction of the ICC, and that there were pending requests for investigations, not only on Palestine, on Gaza, on the Mavi Marmara, on settlements, but also pending investigations against the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan. And the U.S. put enormous pressure on Bensouda, including issuing sanctions against her and her team, denying them visas for coming to present their reports to the United Nations in New York. There was enormous pushback, and basically Bensouda put a halt on those investigations. Now that carried over to Karim Khan. And Khan, from the beginning of his tenure, made it rather apparent that he wanted only to move cases forward that he had a really good chance at winning. And therefore, taking into account the pushback against the prior team, he has exhibited extreme caution in these potential Israeli and U.S. cases. Now, having said that, he has opened investigation on Palestinian cases. I'm not privy to that conversation. You would need to ask the Al-Haq team about that. That's worth a separate conversation about what's happening with that. But he has definitely now indicated that he's going to give the green light. This decision from the ICJ is going to give strength to him and give him a much stronger platform. And especially if other states, parties to the Genocide Convention move, this is going to give him more strength to move on the cases he's already indicated, and perhaps a genocide case on Gaza.
But I hope even that answers the question.
Yeah, no, that was a wonderful answer. I I hope you're right. I'm going to say I'm very skeptical, because I think that if any situation in the world would have demanded indictments, I mean, just the settlements alone, there's so much evidence there that there's no excuse for not issuing indictments. And so I can't help but conclude that this is political, and, you know, that it's just like everything else, Susan. I mean, in Palestine becomes the litmus test in any institution. You have all these various groups that are concerned about human rights all over the world, but then they're silent about Palestine. You have university presidents that brag about how much they protect free speech, but not when it comes to Palestine. I mean, to me, I see it as all part of that continuum. So do you feel that, I mean, this is, you've written so many books and articles about international law, the question of Palestine within international law, refugee rights. And so I don't want to say that, of course, the law is extremely important. But there is a view that, like, oh, this is all a waste of time, because Palestinians have been going to all these international forums for 75 years, if not longer, and they always find a way to slam the door. So you said you're cautiously optimistic. You've talked about the caution. Give us some of the optimism, because I think we need it, but we want it to be grounded in something that we can really take away. I'm sorry to put you on the spot like this, but
it's not on the spot at all. But I'll say what I say to my students all the time. The law is a tool. It is a tool, but it's a very important and consequential tool. But it's a tool that civil society has to know how to use strategically. And I think for many, many years, the Palestinians were very weak on using the law that was strongly in their favor, using it strategically. It has taken a very long time, which is why I often talk about the comparison between the South Africa and Namibia cases. In the effort to end apartheid, they had 5 advisory opinions and a contentious case from the International Court of Justice over the years that provided enormous ammunition to civil society to say, this is what international law is, and therefore our state governments must comply. That's how the whole sanctions regime began. And we had, until the 2004 advisory opinion, nothing from the international institutions on behalf of Palestine. It took that long for the Palestinians to start working in the UN mechanisms. Meanwhile, all of those years, Israel was shoring up its legal arguments, presenting its claims again and again in all of the UN mechanisms, and all that had to be dismantled in order to have the Palestinian law and narrative at the highest UN institutions. And that's what's happening now. That's my optimism, because now we have to, as civil society, learn how to use these rulings that are coming out in favor of the Palestinians. And I mean, catch up with lost time for what needed to have happened after the 2004 advisory opinion. We, by the way, have another advisory opinion coming up. Arguments coming up soon at the International Court of Justice, squarely on settlements and the broader regime of discrimination against Palestinians and the possibility of apartheid. That's coming next. It's moving quickly, but we need to understand how to use these legal decisions in a way that transforms them into implementation. That's why I keep saying it's coming back to civil society. Now it's our job.
And talk more about that. So what would you say for people who are watching from the UK or from Sweden or from Tunis or from Yemen. We have viewers in Yemen too, or from any country, South Africa, India. What should be what are people demanding now? Is it telling their, in addition to, you know, you say the law is a tool, and I think sometimes people can mistakenly think that if we take the law seriously, we think that's the only thing you should take seriously. We, you know, of course, it's a tool that goes along with all the other forms of struggle that people have. But focusing on that, what should people be, and by civil society, you mean everyone, trade unions, individuals, organizations, party activists, anyone. So what specifically should they be asking for in their countries?
So there is there's a huge range of actions, but I'll give you a couple of examples. It's not an accident that we now have something like 60 congresspeople joining on the call for a ceasefire. That would have been unthinkable even 5 years ago. And how has that happened? So groups like the Defense for Children International has had this campaign on No Way to Treat a Child, and the bills that have been sponsored by Betty McCollum. She has herself said she has been educated through this campaign about what is happening in Palestine. And so that campaign has been a combination of activists and legal groups working together with Palestinians to develop the information, to help draft the legislation, to meet with Betty McCollum and her staff and many, many other congresspeople. And that's just one type of action. So thinking about what is strategic depends very much on the context of each country and how well developed the civil society activists are. But for example, here in the Americas, we are talking about what can be done at the Inter-American Human Rights Commission. What kinds of actions can we take as a community in anticipation of this decision from the ICJ and now running with the ICJ decision? What can we do here with our Latin American colleagues to ask for decisions from the Inter-American Human Rights System about what the obligations are for all states, parties of the Genocide Convention in the Americas? That's yet another strategy. So there are many, many ways that civil society first needs to understand what the utility is of this decision, and then how best to adapt their strategies in their context, in their domestic.
We just have a couple more minutes, but Susan, I wanted to just ask you to, you know, kind of contextualize this all, the significance of the ICJ ruling, what could happen next, the ongoing intergenerational trauma that Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, which we haven't really talked about, besides the ICJ ruling in 2004 that ruled that Israel's wall in the West Bank is illegal. This trauma that Palestinians have been suffering for a century, what is the significance at this point of this ruling? And how do you think we are going to be moving forward after this?
Despite my cautious optimism, I think this ruling is hugely consequential, hugely consequential. But how it is implemented, again, I can't reinforce enough that it's going to depend on civil society moving and pressuring their states and holding those states accountable for their joining South Africa in this action. So the onus is on all of us to use whatever mechanisms we have to turn this decision into hard, concrete results. And that's going to take a huge range of ways, a lot of strategizing, a lot of good thinking. But the first thing that needs to happen is education on this decision and on the meaning of this decision and what flows from it. So we need a lot of teach-ins. That's also up to you all. Hopefully you're going to take this forward. But I think the momentum is gathering to end the impunity that Israel has enjoyed for, 100 years. I think negotiations are going to happen, but they're going to be more difficult than ever because of the enormous, enormous suffering of Gazans. I mean, this is yet another generation of trauma. And what is going to happen to those children who have not a single family member left alive? What is going to happen to them? How is Gaza going to be rebuilt? I think one thing this decision is going to put a halt to is the discussion about moving Palestinians out of Gaza. I think that's going to stop as a result of this. But then what happens and who's going to rebuild Gaza and what does it mean to what's happening on a very rapid scale in the West Bank? More dispossession, more settler violence. There has to be a lot of different types of strategies in order to deal with all of the repercussions of what's been happening, not just since October 7th, but the last 75 years.
Yeah. Susan Akram, you are a director. You are the director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Boston University's School of Law, and you're also a professor and author of books and publications and journal articles. Thank you so much for joining us, especially at this very important moment in history and at such short notice. Again, thank you so much for all that you do and for joining us today on the Electronic Intifada.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure, and keep up your good work, all of you.
Thank you so much, Susan. I know that was extremely helpful for me, and we really appreciate it, and we hope to have you back again as this case and the CCR case and also the other advisory opinion before the ICJ comes back. And I'm just seeing, people are very, there is so much disillusionment about all institutions these days that it's very hard for people to get excited about anything because people want an end to the slaughter, an end to the killing. And I think it's important to remember no court decision was going to do that. That the court, there's nothing the court could have said that was going to stop Israel doing what it does right now or immediately. But these are legal processes that provide us with opportunities. And that's, I think, what I took away from this. And we have to also learn the history. I know that the Namibia cases that you mentioned at the ICJ were activated by people. People took those decisions and gave them life and used them to pressure their governments and the world for change. So I think one of the issues we need to do collectively is learn about that history so that we can also figure out how we can use these decisions as one of the tools in this liberation struggle.
Exactly. Exactly right. Yes, exactly right. And that's really my message.
You have been listening to Boston University Law Professor Susan Akram in conversation with Ali Abanima on the Electronic Intifada's Daily Forum. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time and on kkrn.org where you can stream us live every Monday morning at 9 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the internet. Search for truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for joining us today, and we hope you will be with us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.